Okay, so in some texts, feelings are divided into five types. You know, on top of the usual pleasant feelings, suffering, and feelings of neutral feelings, then you have feelings of mental happiness and or mental bliss, or and feelings of mental I don't know what you say, uneasiness, unhappiness. I mean, in Tibetan is yimide. So okay, so yeah, when divided into five, these are the ones. Yeah, okay, pleasant feelings, feelings, suffering feelings, then feelings of mental happiness, feelings of mental uneasiness, and mental unhappiness, right? Then you have neutral feelings. So when divided in such a way, suffering feelings and the pleasant feelings are more like sense consciousnesses, yeah. Okay, and then you have the feelings of mental unhappiness, mental happiness. These are not to do with the mental consciousness, and then you have feelings, neutral feelings, yeah. So of the five omnipresent mental factors, we have finished mental factor of feeling. Yeah. So next is the mental factor of discrimination. So, as you can see in the, on page 20 of the text, the discrimination is a knower that upon the aggregation of the three, object, sense, power, and primary consciousness, apprehends the uncommon sign of an object. So when discrimination is divided, then there are two. Okay, it's at the bottom of page 20, right? The apprehension of a sign and the apprehension of a mark. So basically, apprehension of a sign, the apprehension of a sign is tied in with the sense consciousnesses, yeah. And the apprehension of a mark is related to the mental consciousness. Discrimination is a knower, right? That apprehends the uncommon sign of an object, right? So if discrimination is a knower that apprehends the uncommon sign of an object, so what exactly is an uncommon sign of an object? For example, blue and yellow. Blue is its own entity. It holds its own entity. Yellow holds its own entity, and blue is not yellow. Yellow is not blue. Yeah. So basically, discrimination is that which apprehends such uncommon signs of an object. What is it that allows one to know that it is blue? It is discrimination that apprehends the uncommon blue, that which is uncommon blue, So the mental factor of discrimination occurs in the retinue of both the sense and mental consciousnesses. Yeah. So the discrimination that accompanies the sense consciousness is that which apprehends the sign. Yeah. Okay. And the discrimination that accompanies that is in the retinue of mental consciousness is an apprehension of a mark. So you have an eye primary consciousness apprehending blue, So the eye primary consciousness that branding blue is the main mind, right? So in the retinue of this sense consciousness, there is the mental factor discrimination, yeah. So the discrimination is that which, you know, enables, you know, this eye primary consciousness apprehending blue to apprehend the uncommon blue and not apprehend yellow, for example. So it is discrimination that that causes, you know, the eye primary consciousness apprehending blue to apprehend the uncommon blue that is unshared, yeah, with any other thing, right? And then you have the conceptual consciousness apprehending blue. So in the retinue of this conceptual consciousness apprehending blue, there is also the mental factor of discrimination. Yeah. So this mental factor of discrimination is a discrimination that apprehends a mark. Yeah. And this mental factor of discrimination in the retinue of this conceptual consciousness apprehending blue enables this conceptual consciousness to not mix up blue and yellow. Yeah. And it is this discrimination that allows, you know, this conceptual consciousness apprehending blue to designate, you know, conventionally, oh, this is blue and rather and not yellow, yeah. So in the middle of page 21, you know, the treasury of knowledge explains discrimination as being twofold, yeah? The apprehension of a sign with regard to an object and the apprehension of a sign with regard to a convention, yeah? This is a different way of saying the same thing, yeah? So basically it's a different way of saying what I've just said. Okay, yeah, that's about it for discrimination, okay?
Can we say that this, what Ken Ranger has explained about the uncommon sign, it's the same as saying that the discrimination is that manufacturer which performs a function of apprehending whatever, apprehending the opposite of whatever is not the object. Apprehending the opposite of whatever is not the object. In other words, apprehending the isolate. Can we say that to be the same thing?
If you want to say that, it's fine, I guess. Because, yeah, I mean, blue is basically the opposite of non-blue, right? Opposite from non-blue, right? Yeah, so opposite from non-blue is essentially necessarily blue. Opposite from non-blue is essentially blue. It has to be blue. And that only exists on blue and not on any other thing. So therefore, it is uncommon. It's unshared with... So I think sometimes if you use the word unshared, it may be clearer, yeah? Right?
How does one understand designation, positing or labeling by a non-conceptual consciousness that the discrimination, the manufacture of the discrimination is concomitant with? How does one understand designation, which is reflected in the statement here in the definition, discrimination, right? Designate an expression of objects. All right, so how does one understand designation, which is, I think, mutually inclusive with positing and labeling of a consciousness, of a non-conceptual consciousness? Designation by a conceptual consciousness is clear, but how does one understand designation, labeling, or positing by a non-conceptual consciousness that is done by this mental factor of discrimination?
Wangshi Tonga,
So this is kind of related to the second paragraph, yeah, which says the basis of engagement for these two types of discrimination are perceptions or what you see, yeah? Hearing, differentiation, and knowledge. Their meaning are as follows: perceptions, I think tong, means to see. Involved in designating an expression to objects manifestly perceived. So hearing also involves designating an expression in dependence upon hearing credible words. Differentiation involves designating an expression to objects ascertained in dependence on signs. And knowledge involves designating an expression to objects ascertained directly. Okay, so how... Yeah.
How... Tanya doxina on shirt for the Tanya dox said the Kadena, Judah, Domen Ship, Tanya dox say, Sigame, that's also Tanya Dirty. So one of you did not see the dogs met to ships and so double a shot. Take Tanya double shed, Tanya not so double shed, so double shed, but on shirt out to Tanya dox, Sigame machine.
So usually, it is the conceptual consciousness that designates terms, or that determines or that says, oh, this is this and that is that, right? So, but I don't know whether the discrimination in the retinue of a sense consciousness, whether such a consciousness designates an expression, for example, to an object or not. Yeah. So, you know, when we see blue, for example, technically the eye consciousness is appearing blue. Then subsequent, almost quite immediately after the experience, you know, then you know you have this mind thinking that this is blue, yeah, or on the mind that designates this is blue, yeah. The mind that designates that this is blue, whether that mind is the eye consciousness or not, I think. We have to think about it, yeah. And then, or you know, when you hear something, you know, you hear a sound. So now the ear consciousness is apprehending a sound, you know. I guess it has to be, you know, the conceptual consciousness that distinguishes, you know, what kind of sound, you know, did you hear? Oh, I heard this, I heard that, right? So yeah, usually I mean, you know, when we talk about designating an expression or designating a term, it's mainly done by conceptual consciousness. Yeah. But with regards to how you know these different consciousnesses arise, I think we discussed this before, isn't it? So there's a sense consciousness, then there's a mental consciousness, and then conceptual consciousness is generated, but they're quite quick. Yeah, I mean, you know, the way the manner in which they're generated. So I'm not exactly sure whether a sense consciousness that designates expression or not, you know. Right? So anyway, you know, it is mentioned here that the mental factor of discrimination in the retinue of a sense consciousness is a discrimination that apprehends a sign. And whereas the mental factor of discrimination in the retinue of a conceptual consciousness is a discrimination that apprehends a mark. So from this division of discrimination, you know, one can, you know, understand, you know, that it is mainly the mental consciousness, yeah, that designates, yeah. So when discrimination is differentiated in terms of its basis or support, you know, then there are six, yeah. Starting from the discrimination arising from contact upon the aggregation of a visible form and eye, sense power and eye consciousness and so forth.
What in there shall that in the chimney, Tinet, that's Sumba, that's Samba, said Tata, and it's Gundoma, that's Sumba, that's some Sembe Moni, Gundit Dunes, Samba Consciousness, Sem Number to Yigil, Yavada, Mijawa, the Roma, then Sem Jubach, the Janos.
Okay, so let's look at the third mental, omnipresent mental factor. Yeah. So on the top of page 23. So according to the compendium of knowledge, intention is a compositional mental action of the mind. It has the function of engaging the mind in virtue, non-virtue, or the unspecified.
Sunda
Okay, so it's translated as unspecified, which is I think perhaps more accurate. Yeah, in Tibetan, it's lungma ten. It means literally not shown in the scriptures. A lot of people translate it as neutral. Yeah, I mean, so anyway, that's a technical point. Okay. Okay, just as it has been said above, the mental factor which rouses and moves the mind that is concomitant with it to an object is called intention. So intention is said to be the principle among all mental factors. It is taught that any mind or mental factor engages an object due to the power of this mental factor. For example, just as iron is helplessly drawn by a magnet, the mind helplessly engages an object due to this mental factor of intention. So, you know, when we talk about this mental factor of intention, this mental factor of intention, you know, when we talk about karma, we always say karma, karma, right? This is karma. When we want to say what is karma, intention is basically karma. Karma is intention. This is what we are talking about, yeah. So, this mental factor of intention moves the mind. It moves the mind to an object. So this is what is meant by the mental factor of intention. So whether we talk about the mental factor of intention, you don't think of it in English, yeah. You know intention, you know English, you know, forget about English for now. Yeah. The mental factor of intention is defined here, or karma. We're talking about the same thing. So what exactly is this intention? It is the thing that moves the mind, you know, to an object, you know. It moves the mind towards an object. Yeah. So, you know, there are verbal, physical, verbal, and mental karma actions, yeah. Okay? So there's a mind that moves, you know, and the body, you know, to engage in a certain action. There's a mind that moves, you know, causes a certain kind of speech, yeah. So we talked about this in the previous module, yeah. Quite a lot of detail about the karma, yeah. So in general, there are two types of actions, yeah. Actions that are intentions and intended actions, yeah. And so the three physical actions and the four verbal actions are intended actions, right? Right? Remember? Sambele. Sambele. Right? So Sometimes also I'm confused that dependent on Sempe and Sambile. Yeah, so intended actions are basically, you know, basically physical and verbal actions, right? And actions that are intentions are basically mental actions. So anyway, main thing is you have to understand what exactly is intention. So intention is an omnipresent mental factor. It accompanies all main minds, isn't it? Yeah. Okay? So intention is that which moves the main mind and all the mental factors in the retinue of this main mind towards an object. Yeah. And the analogy is given, right, of a piece of iron that is kind of attracted helplessly, you know, to a magnet. Okay, next is contact. The mental factor of contact. So according to the Compendium of Knowledge, contact distinguishes the transformation of the sense power upon the aggregation of the three. It has the function of acting as a support for feeling. So contact is a knower that upon aggregation of the three, object, sense, power, and primary consciousness, distinguishes an object in accordance with whatever subsequent feeling, pleasant and so on, that is to be experienced. For purpose of understanding, contact is basically literally contact when the mind meets with the object.
Right.
Okay. So contact is the knower that causes the moves, that causes the mind and moves the mind to come into contact, you know, to meet, you know, with the object, you know. So intention arouses the mind. It moves the mind towards the object. Contact causes the mind to meet with the object. So when contact is made, and when contact causes the mind to meet with an unpleasant object, then unpleasant feelings arise. When contact moves causes the mind to meet with an pleasant object, then pleasant feelings arise. So that's why it is said here that the contact distinguishes an object in accordance with whatever feelings, you know, that is to be experienced. Yeah.
Since these five omnipresent mental factors arise, abide, and disintegrate simultaneously, how does one reconcile that contact is a cause and the rest of the other four are results? It seems then that they are not, they don't share a similar time.
What we can say with certainty is like, you know, you know what we have already discussed earlier at the beginning of this text, right? The main mind and the mental factors in the retinue are concomitant by way of the five similarities, one of which is similar time. So that one, bo bian. That's the Bible, right? It has to be like that, right? Okay? That's why sometimes it's very good to employ scriptural authority, you know. You know, when there's nothing much, you know, then, yeah. So we cannot say that the five omnipresent mental factors are generated at different times, because as soon as the main mind comes into being, is produced, these five omnipresent mental factors are produced simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we can say for sure, yeah. Because this is what the great treatises, all the main treatises have stated, yeah. They are produced simultaneously. But in the presentation of the 12 links of dependent or arising, from contact, on the basis of contact, then there's feeling, from feeling, there's craving, from craving, there's grasping, from grasping, there is potential existence. Right? Then birth. So how are you going to explain that? Because feeling and contact are established simultaneously, isn't it? So I don't know exactly, but you can say that with contact as the basis, and then it is possible then for the mental factor of feeling to increase, yeah, to strengthen, So we can't say that there's no feeling when contact comes into being. Yeah. There is feeling there, you have to say, right? Maybe not very big. But you know, but on the basis of contact, then the feeling can grow, yeah. It become, you know, manifest in the set more and stronger. So I don't know, this is something to think about. Perhaps we can say something like this, yeah. But it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly, to be able to say, oh, this is that when we're talking about mind, you know. Right. But what we can say for sure is that the main, all the great treatises are all, you know, all stated very clearly that the five omnipresent mental factors are established simultaneously, right? But for now, at least we can get some idea about these different mental factors, then I think it's enough, yeah. Essentially, feeling accounts for experience, yeah. Right? So discrimination allows us, you know, to know an object, you know. Yeah. That specific object, right? It's discrimination which allows us, yeah. It apprehends the uncommon sign of the object, right? Which is basically that object itself and not something else, right? So then feeling is that which allows us to experience, you know, the object in question. Attention is that which moves our mind towards the object. contact is that which allows us to distinguish the object. You know, contact makes the mind come into contact. You know, to meet with the object, isn't it? Yeah, so I mean the divisions of the various mental factors are there, yeah, in the text, yeah. So if you want, if you can read it on your own, isn't it? If you have anything, then you need to clarify that you can bring it up in class, yeah. Okay, then you have attention, yeah. So it is an engagement of the mind. It has the function of holding the mind to the object of observation. Just as it has been said above, attention is a knower that focuses the mind, which is concomitant with it, on a particular object of observation. Then what is the difference between intention and attention? Intention moves the mind to general objects, yeah, whereas attention directs the mind to a particular object.
So that's the difference. I don't know what I'm talking about. What do you think?
So attention is the that which directs the mind to an object, you know, directs the mind to an object, yeah. It causes the mind to hold on to the object. It is not meditative stabilization. It is like, or you see, this is another difficult word. I mean, you ask 10 different translators, they have 10 different ways of translating. And some say it's meditative stabilization, some say it's concentration. So, anyway, the word is tingezin, which is one of the mental factors. Yeah. Translated as meditative stabilization here in this text. So, attention is like meditative stabilization, tingezin, but it's not meditative stabilization. Yeah. Well, otherwise, all. So what attention does is, you know, it allows the mind to focus and, you know, to hold on to an object without being distracted, without being, you know, thinking about something else, you
know.
Intention moves the mind, rouses the mind, moves the mind towards an object, yeah. But attention holds the mind to that object.
Mm-hmm. 마치 유대였다. 이때 버셔봐. 미워져봐. 어떻습니까? 근데 신사 일하셔봤습니다.
Yeah, so yeah, intention moves the mind towards an object, whereas attention, you know, holds the mind, holds the mind to that object without moving. Okay, so these are the five omnipresent mental factors. Feeling, discrimination, intention, contact, and attention, right? So you just have a kind of a rough idea of their individual entities. So what is the reason for calling these five mental factors, feeling and so forth, omnipresent? They are so called because they are mental factors that accompany all minds. Furthermore, if any of the five omnipresent mental factors are missing, then the utilization of an object will not be complete. So if feeling is absent, there will be no experience. If discrimination is absent, there will be no apprehension of the uncommon signs of the object. If intention is absent, then the mind will not be directed to an object. If attention is absent, the mind will not be focused on a particular object of observation. And if contact is absent, there will be no support for feeling. Okay, so if it is a main mind, it is necessarily accompanied by these five omnipresent mental factors. Okay? Yeah, why? Because if there's no feeling, feeling is not there all the time, then there's no way to experience the object. Yeah. Without discrimination, one will not be able to distinguish the uncommon sign of the object. If there's no intention, the mind will not be directed to an object. So if attention is absent, the mind will not be able to stay on the object. And without contact, the mind will not be able to meet, you know, to literally meet up, you know, with the object. Yeah. I guess you are fine with the five omnipresent mental factors, right?
Huh? Are you present? Huh? Oh, did you hear the shot? But it's Chitane, Chitanko, because she wanna share it. So, law in a patient, that is that patient. Are you my head? Then I double couple of that, some to numb to the capuchu, the capuchu, couple of chipotle.
So I think if you've read the text, I think then whatever I said today shouldn't be difficult. So I think sometimes it's difficult to tell the difference between two mental factors. Yeah, sometimes it seems like we're talking about the same thing. Yeah. Okay, the next category of mental factors are what you call the five object ascertaining mental factors. So the five object ascertaining mental factors are aspiration, belief, mindfulness, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. Okay, so what is aspiration? It is the very wish to be endowed with this or that attribute of a desired thing. And it has the function of acting as a support for making effort. So just as it has been said above, aspiration is a knower that, upon observing some intended thing, seeks it. As for the way in which aspiration acts as a support for effort, so according to the discrimination of the middle and the extreme, the support and that supported by it, and the cause and the result. So we can look at aspiration in terms of three features. Yeah, the object, aspect, and the function. Yeah. Okay. So we can look in aspiration in terms of these three features or characteristics. Yeah. So the characteristic of the feature of the object. So as it's on the bottom of page 26, it says clearly. Yeah. The attribute of a desired thing. Yeah. So what is the aspect, or the subjective aspect of aspiration? It is the very wish to be endowed with it, with the object, the desired object. So what is the function of aspiration? It is the support for making effort. So aspiration possesses these three features. Yeah. Okay, and a knower which possesses these three features is basically aspiration. So the aspiration that we are talking about here in this context mainly refers to the mental factor of aspiration in the retinue of a virtuous main mind. Virtuous main mind, you know? Then there's the quotation from the Lamrim Chenmo, which highlights the great importance of aspiration. Yeah, because with aspiration, if there is an aspiration, then you it's possible to have effort. Yeah, and then and all the excellent qualities comes from effort. So, let's say in relation to achieving meditative stabilization of single pointedness, the single pointedness of mind, and it's very important to have a great, strong aspiration for it. And the cause of such a strong aspiration for wanting to have single pointedness is faith or conviction. How do you gain this faith, faith or conviction how wonderful it is to have calm abiding, for example, single pointedness? You get this faith through hearing about it, hearing, and then reflecting on the advantages, I say, of having single pointedness of mind. And if you have a strong faith or conviction in this, which comes from hearing and reflecting on the advantages of having a single pointedness of mind, then based on this you have a faith or conviction in it. This faith or conviction then is the cause for you to aspire, you know, to really want to have this single pointedness of mind. So with strong faith or conviction, then you have strong aspiration. Strong aspiration leads to strong joyous perseverance. Joyous perseverance is a mind, the definition, is a mind that is enthusiastic about virtue. So with this, with strong joyous perseverance. Then one will make effort. Then you come to then gain, you know, physical and mental pliancy. You know. When physical and mental pliancy is gained, then one overcomes laziness. Yeah. So here, this is using a single pointedness of mind as an object, yeah, as an example. No? So, but the point is, you know, we have to understand how important aspiration is. When there's strong aspiration, then you have strong, joyous perseverance. Yeah. And in relation to, let's say, actualizing calm abiding, you know, when you have strong aspiration for calm abiding, then, you know, then leads you to having strong joyous perseverance in working to attain it. And when one attains it, you know, when you have physical and mental pliancy, then, you know, all kinds of laziness is overcome. Yeah. So for us, basically, you know, whatever we try to achieve, you know, I mean, it's always laziness that blocks us from achieving whatever we want to achieve, isn't it?
What in the age that to that to sin that to my chasm yash, that to that job, prisons of a dweller, that to my chasm yash, what is all this mystery there.
So mainly, we have in the text saying, you know, how important aspiration is, you know, because with aspiration then comes strong effort, and then we'll build a, basically with strong aspiration, then it's possible to really engage, you know, in perfect virtue. Yeah. So then when aspiration is divided, there are the three types, yeah. Aspiration wishing to meet, aspiration wishing to wishing not to be separated from something, and then the aspiration that seeks. The essence, you have strong aspiration, then you have strong joyous perseverance. Yeah. With strong joyous perseverance, one will develop qualities that one has not yet developed. With strong joyous perseverance, the qualities that one has already developed, you'll be able to maintain those qualities without losing them. And then whatever qualities you have accumulated, you have then with joyous perseverance, then those qualities can be enhanced. So the essential point is that What we are seeking to achieve is to gradually to lessen and to remove the non-virtuous minds, and to generate the virtuous minds, and those that have already been generated, then to increase. Yeah. So all of this can only come about through joyous perseverance. And in order to have joyous perseverance, one needs to have aspiration beforehand. So this is how aspiration functions as a support for making effort. You have to understand, yeah. You have to understand this is how aspiration functions as a support for making effort. Yeah. Okay. And then, what is the cause of aspiration? The cause of aspiration is faith. Okay, so the cause, so joyous perseverance comes from aspiration. Aspiration comes from faith. Faith comes from a strong foundation in hearing and listening, hearing the teachings and reflecting on the teachings. With this, and then you generate a stable faith. Stable faith leads to a strong, stable aspiration, which then acts as a support for stable and strong, joyous perseverance. So that's why Lama Tsongkhapa gave a very gave us a strong advice, no, on the importance of hearing, reflection, and meditation. Yeah. Because without hearing, study, learning, without reflection and so forth, nothing happens. Yeah. Nothing happens. Nothing spectacular happens, right? Why? Because without stable learning and reflection, and then meditation, then there's no faith, is it? Neither here nor there. Then because the faith is neither here nor there, then the aspiration is neither here nor there, and then aspiration is neither here nor there, and the effort is also neither here nor there, is it? So basically, nothing happens. Basically, so it all boils down at the end of the day. It boils down to whether one has a stable learning and reflection. Yeah. So yeah, this is really something we have to figure out for ourselves. I mean, you just think about what we have discussed so far. It makes sense, right? It all boils down to whether there is any learning in the beginning, the learning and reflection and then meditation, this three-four process. Yeah. So even just by thinking about this, you then gain faith. You can gain faith in study and reflection. Yeah. Okay, next is belief, the mental factor of belief. What is belief? It holds an ascertained thing to be just the way it has been ascertained. It has the function of non-captivation. Okay, just as it has been said above, belief is a knower which holds the object that has been ascertained by its valid connection, thinking it is just like this and not otherwise. Here, its function is specified as non-captivation. So again, we can look at belief in terms of the three characteristics or features. Yeah. So the object of this mind is something that has already been ascertained beforehand. What is the subjective aspect of this mind, belief? In relation to the object of this mind, it understands the object to be only like this and not other, and not something else. It's like that. Well, the function of belief is non-captivation. Perhaps you can say not impressed. Layman's language. So the function of a belief is specified as non-captivation, non-captivated, you know. Kind of like bohiu, basically. Bohiu, you know. It's like, whatever, you know. But it's not just bohiu, anything, but it is specified as non-captivation because when one has gained firm belief in the object that one has ascertained, an opponent cannot steer one away from it. Yeah. Okay. For example, reflecting upon the difference between the Buddhist and non-Buddhist teachers in the context of going for refuge, when one analyzes which is an infallible refuge, and then when you ascertain that only the teacher, the Buddha, is an infallible refuge, then when the doctrine taught by him and the spiritual community properly at practicing this doctrine are also ascertained by valid conviction to be infallible refuges, a firm belief in them as final refuges is gained. Thereupon, fathers and so forth cannot lead one astray, and one has then joined the ranks of Buddhists. Based upon this, all wholesome qualities will increase. Furthermore, engaging the Bodhisattva deed says, the subduer has taught that belief is the root of all that belongs to the class of virtue, and the root of that is constant meditation on the fruitional results. So what is belief? Belief, you know, is a mind that holds on to an object that has already been ascertained earlier, and it holds on to it as it is, you know, and not something else. It's like that, only like that. This object is like this only.
Oh,
So it is important to have stable belief in the virtuous class of phenomena. So as I said in Vaishantideva in the engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds, belief in the class of virtue, a stable belief, holding on to virtue, and the root of belief is a conviction in cause and effect. So belief is the root of all virtues. So in order to be able to strive in virtue, you basically need belief in it. Belief. But in order to have belief, stable belief, you need to have strong conviction in karma, basically. In cause and effect, Like in the previous lesson that we saw how conviction in actions in karma basically is the correct worldly view, isn't it? The correct worldly view, yeah. So we have this, everything comes, yeah. So with conviction in cause and effect, then one can have aspiration, one can have belief. So remember we talked about inference through belief, yeah. So by thinking about these, this is how you can generate inference through belief, yeah. Okay. So if any questions?
Nah, question then ask.
On page 26, it's more like the English I don't understand. Okay, under the discussion of the category of omnipresent mental factors, it says that furthermore, if any of the five omnipresent mental factors are missing, then the utilization of an object will not be completed, will not be complete. So it sounds like if the function of the five omnipresent mental factors, their function is to use up the object. Why is it not understanding of one object will not be complete? Why is it? I don't understand the term utilization here. Maybe it's a translation question.
You long jib.
Okay.
I don't know what to say. Longju. Here, longju is a verb, yeah. The you know, as a noun, longju is like, you know, we always translate as enjoyments, right? And then to enjoy means to longju. But you cannot talk about, you cannot translate it. In the lamrim context, you can say it, enjoy. But you know, in this kind of subject, you cannot say enjoy. Yeah. I mean, wrong consciousness enjoys what, you know. But it just to say utilize. Basically, you utilize the longju. Longju means to make use. Yeah, longju.
Yeah, use.
Longju.
Can I have two queries? First one is page 19, pertaining to materialistic feeling. Can you please elaborate craving for the contaminated appropriated aggregates? The second question is, if the mental factor can move the mind towards the object, can it also move the mind away from the object?
Aspiration that seeks to be separated. I aspire. Let's have a divorce. Move the mind away from the object. Lose object. Yeah, so intention moves the mind towards an object, yeah. But in order to move towards an object, basically you're moving away from another object, right? Before you can move the mind to an object, right? So essentially when you move the mind to an object, you're moving away from another object, you know. But, I mean, it sounds funny, but if you think about how you move away from a non-virtuous state of mind towards a virtuous state of mind, so that would fit like what you just mentioned, yeah. So it's okay. So in that sense, yeah. So intention is a mover, yeah. It's a mover, yeah. What it does is, it is a mover. It moves the mind towards an object. So if you think about it, you know, in order to your mind to move towards an object, you're basically moving away from something else, yeah. Yeah. So there isn't an intention that doesn't move and stays there, no. That's the very thing about intention is the mover, yeah. And oh, something is chua. Yeah, so yeah, the materialistic feeling, right? Yeah.
Go ahead, Tepo.
Yeah, you want to explain what's the materialistic feeling?
Well, I got other feeling to ask. Is the mental factor of feeling that accompany a sense consciousness and a mental factor of feeling that accompany a mental consciousness, are they different or same substance? That means these two mental factors, right? One is a bodily feeling, one is a mental feeling. Are they considered different substance?
You're talking about two feelings accompanying one main mind.
different in mind. One is sensual consciousness, one is mental consciousness.
Then?
So let's say we have two different in mind. So these two mental factors of feeling are different substances or same?
What do you think?
Looks like different. But then within itself, the sense consciousness, you have the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness. So are these mental factor of feeling that accompany these two different main mind same or different substances? I mean, even within the sense consciousness, you have the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, right?
Ear consciousness and eye consciousness are same mind or different mind?
A different main mind. So different substance.
What do you think?
I don't know. That's why I'm here. What differentiate being different substance? Because of sense power? It looks like I'm answering myself. Yeah, I better go back.
Sakshi,
So what are materialistic feelings? You could say that the materialistic feelings refer to the mental factor of feeling that is concomitant with a contaminated consciousness. And what's the other one? Non-materialistic feelings are basically the mental factor of feeling that is concomitant with a uncontaminated wisdom.
I was thinking last time when you mentioned that before time of death is nearing, you crave for the cell to continue to live longer. Can this be the craving for the contaminated appropriated aggregate? And also during the Bardo state, another person told me, you also crave for a body to be quickly reborn, to take rebirth. Can it be this related to materialistic? Other people, they interpret as related to attachment and desire.
So can you...
So yeah, it is essentially basically when we talk about materialistic feelings, the feelings are concomitant with craving. But there are different kinds of craving. Craving for the body, craving for an existence. So many different kinds of craving. So the mental factor of feeling concomitant with craving is basically a materialistic feeling.
I didn't hear what the bone said that time. Yeah. Any question? I will stop here.
So the aggregation of the three are all reflected among all these five the omnipresent manner factors. My question is specifically about the observed object of a sense consciousness will be the sense object, whereas the observed object of a mental consciousness is a phenomenon form source or phenomenon source form. So the problem is that, for example, an eye conscious apprehending blue and a mental consciousness apprehending blue, the observed object is blue. Whereas here, we understand it to be sense object and phenomenon source form. So even though you call it blue for both types of consciousness apprehending its object, they are different here. Sense object and phenomenon source form. But then when you call it, you call them by the same term.
Same term called.
Where is it said to be the same?
So the eye conscious appearing blue, the observed object is blue. A conscious conceptual consciousness or a mental direct perceiver appearing blue, its observed object is also blue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So they are all called, both called blue.
Yeah.
However,
is it the same blue?
Yeah, that's my qualm here.
Yeah, same blue.
It's the same blue.
Yes.
But then you have look at the sense object for the five sense consciousnesses. They are the respective sense objects, right? Mm-hmm. Blue, sound, whatever it is. Whereas for conceptual consciousness, whether conceptual or non-conceptual, for a mental consciousness, whether it's conceptual or non-conceptual, the observed object is that object itself, blue, sound, or whatever it is. So it's still the same.
Yeah.
So a phenomenon, form, source, and a sense object will not be different in that sense.
They're different.
Yeah, but then when we call the observed object, so that means the observed object and the sense object and phenomenon, form, source, they are not referring to the same thing. The observed object condition or object or observation of the consciousness and the sense object and the phenomenon form source, they are not the same?
Not same. Yeah.
How are they different in that sense?
So what is phenomenon source here? Yeah? Phenomenon form source. I don't know. Well, how do they translate it? Phenomenon source from Chu. Okay, anyway. Okay, phenomenon source form. Okay, what is a phenomenon source form? It is a form that cannot be, that is not an object of apprehension of sense consciousness. It can only be an object of apprehension of a sense of mental consciousness. Yeah. That is a phenomenon source form. But we're not saying that whatever appears, whatever that appears to the sense consciousness does not appear to the mental consciousness.
So
when we are talking about blue, so whether it is an eye consciousness apprehending blue or mental consciousness apprehending blue, the blue as the observed object is the same blue. So it's Not so much about whether it's a form or. So the form that appears to a conceptual consciousness apprehending blue, basically is blue. Yeah, I mean it's not the phenomenon source form.
Yeah.
So it is the thing that appears to a the thing that the conceptual consciousness apprehending blue is apprehending, you know, the object of this consciousness. It is not the blue that cannot appear to a sense consciousness. So basically, if you know what is a phenomenon source form, then it is clear. Yeah? What is a phenomenon source form? It is a form that cannot be an object of a sense consciousness. It can only be a form of a for a mental consciousness. That's all. For example, the elephant that appears in a dream. So the dream elephant is a phenomenon source form. Phenomenon source form, yeah. Okay. Okay, so please continue to read the text on your own, like the divisions and of the respective mental factors, and then if you have any questions, you can bring it up in class, okay? Okay, so yeah, we'll finish. And so.